go back, if you will, some time to your youth, when you may have heard the voice, not knowing it was the voice, not even suspecting. Perhaps you called it a hunch or an instinct, and later as you grew up you used the word intuition. You said, I feel a certain way, and I feel confident, and this is what I'm going to do. And nothing could sway you. One way or another, you were in communication, perhaps, with the voice, and yet it wasn't clearly defined. And then perhaps one day you actually heard the voice, and without these preparations, without those moments of pure, undiluted intuition, you would have been frightened. You might have said, I'm hearing sounds within myself. I better see a psychiatrist. Or maybe I'm becoming double-minded. Maybe that accident had an effect upon me. Always, the voice has surprised those who receive it. And yet there are times when the preparation for the voice is so complete that it comes to you as if you were old friends. The importance of the voice is that once having been assured from within, directly, not by a person outside, not by a situation, but by the actual voice, and having found that voice to be true, dependable, in fact, sometimes so powerful that it sweeps aside all that had appeared to be opposition. Having undergone the experience one time or another, to you, God is no longer a word in a book or something you pray to out there and up there. There is a new relationship established. And from this confidence that comes when the voice directs you, you are prepared to be fed by the infinite in such a way that from within you build out of your own substance, your own fabric, a new life. Greater am I in the midst of you than in the world. And this word greater begins to open up, greater in every way, greater intelligence, greater power, greater health, greater abundance, greater faculties, greater harmony, greater peace. If you will make the about face, the turning, which the Bible calls the repenting, and begin to live from this I which does speak. Now there was a man in the wilderness. Life was pretty harsh to him at this particular moment. Everything he tried seemed to fail. He even wanted to die. He had seen his beloved nation turning away to a golden calf. He had seen Judea turn to worship Baal. And in the wilderness he prayed to God and said, let me die. What have I to live for? Jezebel has my countrymen. She has married the king. She has turned him. I don't even have a student. Not one person who can carry on the word. I have failed. But then came the voice. And for Elijah, everything changed. He was hungry. He had no food, but it appeared. He had no followers, but he was assured that there were 7,000 who had not bowed to Baal. And the voice guided him. And don't you realize that the voice fed him? That the voice sustained him? That the voice directed him? That the voice prepared those who would listen to his story? Where else could Elijah have received the help that came to him? He didn't have any books in the wilderness. He had no radio and no TV. He was alone to all outward appearances. But from that moment, when he was fed by ravens, everything changed for Elijah, and that voice within proved, "Greater am I in the midst of you." It was Jezebel in the end who was put to flight. Now let's look at Elijah. Let's see if we can find in his story something in our story. He himself went a day's journey into the wilderness, came and sat down under a juniper tree. He requested for himself that he might die. He said, "It is enough now, O Lord, take away my life, for I am no better than my father's." As he lay and slept under a juniper, behold, an angel touched him and said unto him, "Arise and eat." What is this angel? Did a little Cupid on wings appear in the wilderness? Or was it an inner impulse, as all angels are? What is this angel then that touches you and gives you an awareness above your normal mind, your normal sensibilities? What is this angel that brings you the inner word? It says now to Elijah, "Arise and eat." He looks around. "Where can I eat? There's nothing here to eat." But the higher self, the I, knows there's something to eat, and even appears as something to eat in a most miraculous way. Can we accept that the eye of our being can do this? That it knows no limitations that we know? That it can manufacture out of essence that which is needed for this day? Elijah, arise and eat. How well we remember a later phrase, "Arise, pick up thy bed and walk." The same I in Elijah that spoke through Jesus, the very same I, the very same words, "Arise," the very same words that Jesus used to the daughter of Jairus, "Arise, maid, arise, lift up your vision. Lift up the eye in the midst of you. Lift up your consciousness and eat. Food is present. Your human eyes don't see it, but arise and you will see the food." And now the eye in the midst is being lifted in Elijah. The world isn't going to be as black as it was because he is receiving new vision from within. He's not going to want to die anymore. He has a mission now. And he looked. He looked where? He was looking in his own soul. That's where you look. His own soul was looking and beheld that food which was invisible heretofore to human eyes. Behold, there was a cake baked on the coals and a cruse of water at his head. And he did eat and drink and laid him down again. Out of nowhere, he was fed. It won't come the same way to everyone, but it does come. And the angel of the Lord came a second time and touched him and said, "Arise and eat, because the journey is too great for thee." And he arose and did eat and drink, and went in the strength of that meat 40 days and 40 nights unto Horeb, the mount of God. Just like Jesus later, 40 days. Just like Moses, 40 years. In other words, in this I, living in inner communion, he was lifted to the Christ consciousness. I in the midst of thee, raised up, will lift all men unto me. Now he was on Mount Horeb, the mountain of high consciousness. Now things were different. Now he beheld a new heaven and a new earth. There was a transformation of consciousness. I, in the midst of him, made all things new. He came hither unto a cave and lodged there, and behold, the word of the Lord came, said unto him, "What doest thou here, Elijah?" And he said, "I've been very jealous for the Lord, God of hosts, for the children of Israel have forsaken thy covenant. They have thrown down thine altars. They have slain thy prophets with a sword. And I, even I only, am left, and they seek my life. No, take it away." And he said, "Go forth and stand upon the mount before the Lord." And behold, the Lord passed by, and a great and strong wind rent the mountains, and brake in pieces the rocks before the Lord. But the Lord was not in the wind. And after the wind, an earthquake. But the Lord was not in the earthquake. And after the earthquake, a fire. But the Lord was not in the fire. And after the fire, a still small voice. All these degrees, the wind, the earthquake, the fire. And then, Christ realized the still small voice. When Christ was realized within, he then heard, "Yet I have left me 7,000 in Israel, all the knees which have not bowed unto Baal, and every mouth which has not kissed him." And he learned that the Spirit of the Lord had gone before him to do what no mortal man can do. So with each of us, it matters not what the picture is this moment. It mattered not what the picture was that moment to Elijah. It mattered not what was presented to the man called Jesus. Never was the picture true. Always the inner self was present, perfect, functioning. Always God is. We learn that our entire human lifespan is an initiation, from birth to death. It is a building process in which we become aware of I, who speak, who go before you, who lead you, who teach you, who feeds you, and ultimately who resurrects you out of the tomb of a human span. When we sit back and try to coax I to come to us, we find that we fail. It is necessary to prepare for I to speak. And that preparation is very clearly given to us by Jesus in the Sermon on the Mount. The preparation is what may be called the transmutation of karma. You come into this world not knowing where you've been, what you've been, or who you've been, or what you've done. Your karma goes before you. It must be forgiven by deeds. You must pay your debts. And these debts are the violation of the truth of identity, the unknowing that follows, the emptying out of all of the false concepts is the way you transmute your karma, the way you pay your debts, releasing every belief that is contrary to the perfection of God. Now, until this is done, I cannot speak to you. I cannot speak where there is a division in consciousness. I cannot speak to a mortal being. I, life, can only pour through one who is living in the spiritual identity. And therefore, I who speak can only speak when you have accepted that identity. The transmutation of karma is the way in which you forgive all others as you are to be forgiven of their violations of truth. But now we're coming to a place where I must be seen in a much broader aspect than the human self who sits here and says, I'm going to wait for that voice to speak to me. These are not the proper conditions for receptivity to the voice. I'm going to suggest to you several things you shall do successfully in order to make the voice a habitation where it feels the invitation of your soul. If you have seen the I in your friend, in your loved one, in yourself, you will need no instruction on how to go further, because that I will take you all the distance. But if you have not yet seen that I, it is because you have not been willing to see it everywhere. All of us, at one time or another, are very anxious to claim divinity, spiritual identity, while we are unwilling to claim that identity in others. Now, it is very difficult to build the awareness of I in everyone you see. And yet, until you do, all of the previews you may have had of the voice, all of the preliminaries, will have failed to arouse you to the level where the voice is your permanent dispensation. If it came to you last October, and you said, my, that's marvelous, but you didn't take that as a command to recognize the I everywhere, don't be surprised if it hasn't returned. We are given glimpses of it only to know that it is there. But every time we receive a glimpse of it, it is saying to us, now that I have given you a preview, if you want more, here is what you must do. And part of that is seeing
not the form but the eye of an individual. And this demands many, many months of practice. Some of you may be unwilling to give it that practice. Others will accept nothing less. Now what I mean is this. There's a sequence. The first thing you see of an individual is the form. And if you remember, you think of the eye. We want to reverse that. We want to be conscious of the eye. And if the form must be something you're aware of, that comes number two. Now, this is a training to look directly at a form of a person, of a tree, of a stone, of a bird, of any object, any person, anything, and any condition, to look everywhere, being first eye conscious and then form conscious. You'll miss the first 10 times, 20 times, 30 times, and each time you miss, you must remember to correct it. So that when we greet each other, the first thought in your consciousness is, there is I. And then you become conscious of the form. Always in that instant, when you first accept the I and then the form, you are fulfilling the intelligence of that I which says, I in the midst am greater than he who walks the earth. Now this eye that you look at, which is invisible to your human sense, is yourself. And as long as you are unwilling or unable to make the constant effort to recognize this eye, which is yourself in every form, you are not preparing for I who speak. Because I, being infinite, speak infinitely. And unless you are living in the I which is infinite, which is the substance of every form, you are cutting off your access to the voice. Now, this is a turning away from everything you see and accepting it as the eye of your being first. And there are no exceptions. Friend and foe, bird and cat, every material object in this world must be seen as your invisible eye. Until this is away. And then every time you miss, you must be aware you have missed so that you can make the instant correction. And if you fail the whole first hour, you must be willing to do it again the second hour and the third and the fourth. You must be willing to do this as long as is necessary until between you and everyone you meet there is an invisible binding instantly in your consciousness, like a steel rod between you and that individual. Closer to you, stronger in your consciousness than anything else about that person. The moment you see that person, there should be this steel rod springing up inside, which is your consciousness of the I, that the I of me here is my name, and the I of me in that person is my name. There and here I am. This I is more important than that person and than your person. When you have established that, you will know that the I of you is where the person is and where the form of you is. This constant practice builds your consciousness that the I of you is infinite. It centers your complete attention on this I. It takes you out of that personal sense of self, that human ego, which is so busy fulfilling its personal desires. It makes you one with the source of all things. And until you've made the effort, you can't possibly guess how this can change your complete experience. Now you're going to see all ages. And it won't make any difference if you're looking at an infant or an adolescent or a middle-aged person or an older person. The truth is always the same. Instantly, I there and I here are one and the same, without separation. And then, as you begin to be aware of this, as you begin to feel this, you'll find your relationships are changing. And the I which you are acknowledging in the midst of you and the other individual, as your self, it will begin to guide you, to regulate and adjust all of your commerce with that individual. Whatever is involved with that individual will become guided under the law of I. Now, I know from experience that I cannot do this just because I start to do it, because it's a long habit that has been ingrained in us to recognize form as a person. This form is Geraldine. This form is Mary. This form is Susie. This form is Harry. But no, neither of those forms are important to us, because where the four forms are, I am. And until I can establish that in consciousness, I have not crucified form in my consciousness. And I cannot be resurrected in my consciousness. And then the speaking of I is impossible, because I've not established the oneness that is necessary. But if everyone in this room was seen by you as I, or even two, then you would have two or more, and I would be in the midst of them. If everyone in this room was seen by you as I, you could rest with the knowledge that the law of divinity would regulate your activity with every person here. Every form would come under the law of I, because where the form is, the I of you truly is. You're getting out of your form. You can accept the I there, but now you're accepting it where everyone else is. And no matter where form appears, the I of you is. This is a prerequisite to finding the kingdom of heaven, where I speak. As you practice it more and more, and its power becomes clear to you, you will understand that there is no form anywhere that need concern you in the slightest, whether it owes you money or you owe it money, whether it's antagonistic to you or you to it. There is no power in form when you have accepted that wherever form appears, I the self of you is. This essence that you are is where your child is, your mother, your father, your enemy, your friend. This essence that you are is throughout this universe. This essence that you are is the sea of spirit without boundary or limitation. This essence is called I, and it is everywhere. And it is your name. It is your identity. It is your being. And unless you claim it to be your being first, you will be fooled by the forms, and you will think that you are separate and apart from those forms. You are not separate and apart from those forms. Every form is a concept entertained about the one invisible essence, the I, the being, that is invisibly present everywhere. Never are you separate from any one, because the you that is separate is not you. You are the essence of God. Where you stand and where your neighbor stands, both places are the essence of God which you are. And unless you are unified in I, knowing you are never separate from another because only the essence of you is there, I cannot speak to you. Now let us establish then that in this room is one essence. We're not concerned about our forms for the moment. I am that substance which is I, which exists throughout what we call inner space and outer space, time, place, condition. All these things are in I. Now let's go to the well of Samaria. Here's a woman pumping and pumping and pumping. But I am there. She doesn't recognize I. All she knows is she's got to get water out of that well, but I am there. The I of you is right where this woman is pumping. She doesn't know it. Every day she's pumping more water, and now there's another man there, and that's the I of you. The I of you is both Jesus and the woman pumping at the well. Only in Jesus, the I is realized. In the woman, the I is not realized by the woman. In Jesus, the I is realized by Jesus. He knows the I of himself to be the I of the woman, as you know the I of you to be the I of him and the I of her. You are there this moment. It is yourself. And the I of you, speaking through Jesus, says to the woman, if you knew me, you wouldn't have to pump like that. And she doesn't understand. And she keeps pumping. Now, isn't that not a perfect example of what we have been doing all our lives? She does not see the I, she sees a man. You do not see the I of you, you see a man or a woman where you are. And so you keep pumping at the well. When you read, we don't have to strive for a living in I, it sounds like words in a book again. Why? Because we're pumping and pumping as a human being. But right there is I. And when you touch that I, that's the end of all the pumping. Everywhere you look in all of the healings, they are all demonstrating that wherever I is realized, there's nothing to be healed. It's the unwillingness or the unawareness that where you stand, I am. And in that unawareness that I am standing where you are, you live in this me, blind to the I that is your being there, blind to the essence but aware of the form. When the essence is what makes the form possible. The essence is not in the form. The I is not in the form. The form is in the I. The form is in the essence. That's the nature of the illusion. Not knowing that the form is in the I. The I is greater than the form. Bigger than the form. We are walking in the I of our own being. Our form is in the I of our own being. The early Christians were called fishes for that reason. They were forms in the ocean. They were being told, you're just a fish. You're in something bigger than a fish. You're in the ocean. Translated spiritually, you're in the sea of spirit, which is I. Right now, you're standing in your own eye, but only aware of the form of you and not the fullness of the eye that envelops, embraces, and encompasses that form. And so the form walks forth unaware of the greatness of its own being surrounding it. It's a fish in the ocean, unaware of the ocean. But when you become aware of the ocean of spirit around you, which is I, you see that same ocean of spirit encompasses every other form on the earth. Every form on this earth is walking in the one eye of your being, the one sea of spirit. And that is why there is unity in I and division in me. In me, I am separated from your form. In I, the sea of spirit joins us so that we are two separate forms in one, same, indivisible I. And when your consciousness rests on the indivisible I, which embraces all forms, and your identity is that I, we are no longer brothers and sisters. We are the one I. And that consciousness is the consciousness in which I speaks. Now the power of I, when it speaks, is such that there is no power on the earth to oppose it. It makes no difference what the nature of the problem is, how critical, how impossible, how beyond all mortal knowledge, how beyond every X-ray chart. When I speak, the earth melts. All through the Bible, practically every book of the Bible has a reference or more to I. Ezekiel, Daniel, Leviticus, Exodus, Deuteronomy, just go through them and everywhere you find these subtle allusions to the voice and the power of the voice. Job, 3,000 years ago, heard the voice. And often it's referred to as the thunder of his voice, and mistaken to mean that God is wrathful or angry at the world when they're talking about that inner thunder, the thunder of the silence within, the thunder of that voice within which breaks every shackle, which opens eyes, which opens ears, which straightens bones. In other words, the inner voice is the power. the omnipotence of God made audible in the soundless sound. The inner voice speaks with tongues. When it speaks, everything must manifest in accordance with its voice. This must become real to us. Now, if you've had the experience of the voice, you know that you can depend upon it. You can follow it blindfolded. It goes before you. It really does prepare a table in the wilderness. It really does take you through new mansions. And everything you do to make possible your receptivity to the voice is helping your own eventual realization of heaven on earth. I hesitate to talk about what the voice says. Tell no man, we're told. Even we are told never to use the phrases that come so sacredly, except if we're teaching. And somehow I've always felt in a class that that's somewhat a little too public, especially when it goes out on tapes. But there have been so many beautiful experiences of the voice that I don't think for my own self that I could have possibly ever wanted to teach this message if I had not first heard the voice. Because with it, there's a feeling of ordination. Without it, I can't possibly imagine that I have anything to say. Of my own self, I can do nothing. But that voice, it seems to give you an awareness of a land that you've never seen. It seems to tell you that if you're faithful to my direction, my guidance, you will see this land. It seems to say, I can take you out of the dying sense of self into the undying self. It seems to contain within itself the fulfillment of everything in the Bible that we have called a promise. When it says, I am the way. Now there is nobody who can make that voice come. There's nothing you can do to make it come and say, now I'm ready. Even Samuel, when he said, speak, Lord, thy servant heareth, wasn't making the voice come. He was merely indicating that he had prepared faithfully to receive it. Paul didn't make the voice come, but it spoke to him when he was blinded at Damascus, told him where to go, to Ananias to be healed. And he went and he was healed. Always, when the voice speaks, it is not just the word of this moment. Everything in the outer manifestation is completed at the same instant. It is a complete experience. From the moment that the voice said, go to Ananias to be healed, there was no question but Paul would have his eyes back. And even Ananias received the same voice telling him that Paul would come. Now, when we are told to die to self, it means die to limitation. Die to the finite self. Die to the limited self. Die to that self which only knows what it has experienced up to now. What it means be born become alive to the self which can do all things. You may have thought that you were seeking God and have discovered too that the ego of you sought God, but you didn't really. The ego sought God for its own personal purposes. And if you overcame the ego which was seeking God and sought God for God's sake, you knew the difference. And then there's still another place where you find you haven't really been seeking God fully, in the sense that you're holding back just a little, unwilling to say, "Father, here I am," turning myself over to you completely, so that there's nothing left here except a desire to be in you, a complete and total surrender, where there's not a concept remaining, not a person here wanting God, but a total about-face in which you completely give yourself to I.
Like that couple who came into the disciples and one held some money back. Peter discovered it, and the man was killed instantly. This was telling us that you can't hold a remnant of yourself back. All of you has to be given to I. There are critical emergencies when you forget yourself completely, and that's when I seems to make itself known to some of us. This crisis comes up and you're spellbound. But I takes over. Many persons who have never had the I experience have had it in moments like that. They're taken right out of their human selfhood. They're scared out of their wits. They're numbed, paralyzed. And in that moment when they are, I seems to come. A glimpse. And they think it's a miracle that everything clears up. It isn't a miracle at all. I simply reveals itself. Now, when you come out of the dying self, the mortal self, and accept I here and I there as I, you can see why there are subtleties in the Bible that cannot begin to be understood until you know that I here and I there is your name. For instance, you see that Jesus was demonstrating I here and I there. He was demonstrating the nature of that infinite I. Here's Jesus over here as a form. Here are the starving multitudes as forms, but it's all in the I. And here is the fulfillment of their hunger out of nowhere, but really coming out of the I. That I wasn't inside the form of Jesus alone. He was demonstrating that that I is elsewhere beside in his form. The I of Jesus was not located in his form. It was everywhere that manna was appearing out of the sky. That I was out of the limitation of the dying Jesus, of the mortal Jesus, of the form Jesus. He was demonstrating that the I of his being was not bounded by the form. You must learn that. You must learn that the eye of your being is not bounded by your form. And that's why you must learn to recognize the eye of your being in every object that you see.
even silly little things, a piece of string, everything that you see, you must register as being possible only because there is an eye of you that is there. Now, don't make the mistake of thinking that string is the eye of you, or that person is the eye of you, or that dog is the eye of you. They are not. I have had the eye of me tell me very forcibly they are not. I is never anything but I. I is never the person. I is never the object or the condition. I is always I. That's your name. You're never anything but I. You're never the form. I isn't being your form. I is being I, and you are that I and not the form. Don't make the mistake of saying I is the substance of this physical form. It isn't. I is your name. And don't hold on to the form like those two who came into the disciples and held a little money back. Let go of the form. Once you are willing to accept the I, accept it as 100% of you. Then there's no materiality still remaining. You're not holding out a little. Then you're in the infinity of your being. Then you're in unlimitation. You have no boundaries. You have no finitude. There must be a knowledge that I am I, not form. And right where your neighbor is, that I there is you, and not the form of the neighbor. The I of you that is there is all that is there. Until the forms to you are mental images. And the I of you is the only reality. Everywhere. What's between the I of you and those mental images? A mind. Without that mind, there'd be no mental images. There would only be I. The image maker, the mind, is converting I into a sense of form. The form is never there, I am. Give the universe back to I. Accept yourself as the I. Do it every opportunity you have. When you say grace at your breakfast table, at your dinner table, be aware that the objects that are there, the food that is there, the plates that are there, all this is made possible only because there is an invisible I. And it is so vast, so incomprehensible, that all of the objects that we see in this world are our concepts about that invisible I. We're living in the world of effects or concepts about that invisible I. And we are learning to accept the invisible source which makes these objects possible in the visible world. When you live in that invisible source and claim it to be your name, everywhere, your being, these objects in the visible take on the qualities of I. Never do they become I, but they take on the qualities of I. They come closer to the divine. That grapefruit, that orange, that peach, you must know that this could never be on the earth if there were not an invisible eye, the eye of you. And then through processes, through world mind and individual mind, we have trees, leaves, blossoms, fruit. I is the invisible reality. And all the rest becomes concept about the infinitude of I. But when you're living in the I, you are in the source, governed by the source. And your life shows forth the perfection of the source. You are in the substance. You're not living in effect. It wouldn't matter if you had taken all of the notes in the world about what we're discussing here, if you went no further. It must be your living consciousness that I of you is all there is in this universe, and it is everywhere, and that means you are everywhere as that I. You are behind everything that appears. I am the Father, one. The Father is behind it all. Father and I are one. I am behind it all. And that's where you rest, in that knowledge. And then the voice does speak. And it does thunder. And it does guide. And it does light your path. And it does the miracle work. To whoever is faithful to I am faithful. I can never function except through your enlightened consciousness that I am present. When you acknowledge this invisible presence behind all things as your presence behind all things, then you're not limiting I to you. You're not saying over here is I and I'm going to have a little fence around it and that's I. Now, this should be practiced until it's daily consciousness. Grace becomes a different way of saying grace. It also becomes a way of reminding yourself that this object that I'm about to eat isn't I. I'm not about to eat myself. But this object is a group of qualities held together in mind. And that mind is forming a concept or group of concepts about I. And over there, there's another object. And that is held together in mind because it is a group of concepts about I. Always, everything is a group of concepts about I. That's how miraculous I am. And up and down every street and every highway, there's no empty space. There's always invisible I. There would be no buildings if there were no invisible I. There would be no streets. There would be no pipes under the streets. There would be no electricity, no lights. All of these are our concepts about the qualities of I. And when we graduate from the concepts, we will find higher concepts. That's why we have improvements. And ultimately, we go beyond the concept to the I itself, which is its own sun, its own light, its own time, its own space. And no more do we have concepts about it. We're coming out of the dying self, out of the time-space limited concept of self, out of the form self, out of the dying form self. That is the importance of the message of Christ. It takes you out of the dying form. It crucifies the concept and resurrects us into the reality. I can never leave you. I am an infinite voice. When you surrender to the voice, it is not just a little glimmering inside you. You are swallowed up by the infinite. You rest in the infinite voice. And that infinite voice is the universal consciousness of God.